Okay, good evening, everyone. Good evening. We're going to get started right now. My name is Tarif Abdulmanum. I'm from the University of Nebraska Public Policy Center, and I'm the coordinator of the Thomas C. Sorensen Public Policy Seminar Series. And I really want to thank you all for coming to tonight's talk. This is Climate Change and Human Health, featuring Dr. Wendy Ring. Now, before I introduce Dr. Don Wilhite, I'd like to acknowledge all the partners and co-sponsors who've been involved in helping put together tonight's forum. As some of you may know, there are several national organizations that have helped support Dr. Ring's visit to the state of Nebraska, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, Climate 911, and Healthcare Without Harm. So I'd like to thank those organizations and also encourage all the members of this audience to learn a little bit more about what those organizations are doing by visiting their web pages on the internet. Locally, there are a number of partners who've really been integral in terms of helping put together this forum here tonight. The School of Natural Resources, National Drought Mitigation Center, and OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute here at Lincoln, are all co-sponsors of today's event. Also, the UNL College of Arts and Sciences, they provide support to the seminar series through the Thomas C. Sorensen Endowment. So I want to thank all those entities, especially the College of Arts and Sciences. They've been very supportive of this speaking series from the beginning, and so I want to acknowledge their ongoing support. In addition, our friends over at UNMC, the UNMC College of Public Health, as well as the UNMC College of Nursing Lincoln campus, have also been very enthusiastic supporters of tonight's event. So I want to thank our friends over at UNMC as well. Now, before I introduce Dr. Wilhite, I do have a bit of housekeeping here. When you entered, you should have received a one-page evaluation form. We'd really love to learn from you all what you think about this forum. So before you leave tonight, if you could fill this out and return that to myself or to Maggie. I'm not sure where Maggie is, but make sure you fill this out and leave it with us. Oh, there's Maggie standing in the back. We'd love to get these back from you. Should only take about a minute. And also, I want to thank a couple of people who've really been helpful in terms of helping bring Dr. Ring here and making this event happen. And those are Nicole Wall with the National Drought Mitigation Center, Tanya Bernat with National Drought Mitigation Center, and Lisa Panisi. I'm not sure where Lisa is. But thank you, Nicole, Tanya, and Lisa, and I look forward to working with you again in the future. And also, there are a couple of people who've also been really helpful behind the scenes as well. Mike Hayes, Don Wilhite, Sandy Schofield, Dee Aguilar from the OSHA Lifelong Learning Institute, and also Jenna Pressler from the College of Nursing Lincoln campus. So I want to thank all those individuals as well. Okay, so now I'd like to introduce Dr. Don Wilhite. Don is the founding director of the International Drought Information Center and the National Drought Mitigation Center. He's the former director of the School of Natural Resources. His principal areas of research expertise are in drought preparedness, mitigation, and policy. Don has provided leadership in this area locally, statewide, nationally, and internationally for many, many years, and we're very glad to have Don here at the University of Nebraska. So please welcome Professor Don Wilhite.
Thank you, Tarif. Well, I want to welcome all of you to this particular forum, this lecture. You know, we hear so much about climate change, but I think most of what we hear is focused on various sectors such as agriculture, water resources, and so forth. And also we hear a lot about the science of climate change. We don't hear an awful lot about the potential impacts of climate change on human health. Working in the drought area, this is an area that's important. The connection between drought and human health is also an important link, but one that we don't hear as much about as we really should. We're about to hear a lot more about climate change in the next few months, because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is about to issue their new assessment report. The last one was issued in 2007, and won the Nobel Peace Prize. So the new report is coming out. Parts of it are going to be released the end of this month. And also, from a more national perspective, we're about to see the release of the National Climate Assessment Report, which was released in January of this year for public comment. And in fact, we hosted a town hall meeting on the National Climate Assessment Report here in Hardin Hall in this auditorium in February of this year. And so that was part of the public comment process. So the final report is going to come out at the end of the year. So when these reports come out, what happens is there's a huge spike in media coverage associated with climate change, the science of climate change, potential implications of climate change on many different sectors, including comments, of course, about human health. So we're really pleased today to have Dr. Wendy Ring with us. She's going to talk about climate change and health impacts. She and her husband are bicycling across the United States carrying this message. And so it's been, I think she started in July, and she's here, and this will end, I guess, in October, I think you were saying. Dr. Ring received her MD degree and a degree also in sort of public health from Yale University and Columbia Universities. She served as Director of Community Health Center in California for more than 20 years and has been working with groups on this issue of climate change and health impacts for quite a while. So we really appreciate you being here and sharing your message with us. So I will turn the microphone over to you. Thank you.
Can everybody hear me?
Well, as soon as the green, there you go.
Yeah, it is on. Yeah, can you hear? Great, okay. Thank you all for being here. Climate change is, for most of us, a pretty distressing subject, and so I really appreciate your willingness to come here and get more distressed. But after we talk about all of the problems that climate change is causing for human health, we're going to talk about some solutions. So we will be ending on a positive note. Don't despair. So a kid with a swollen eye, another boy with behavior problems at school, a woman with some memory problems, a man with a chronic cough. Just another day at the office, right? Nothing we haven't seen before. When I was in medical school about 30 years ago, I had a professor who used to say, when you hear hoofbeats, don't think of zebras. Just meaning that common things are common. And now, unfortunately, with climate change, physicians have to think about zebras. And because things are changing and we're seeing new conditions and we're seeing increases in the numbers of people affected and the severity of conditions that we're familiar with. So extreme heat is one of the most obvious effects of climate change and something that we've been experiencing here recently in Nebraska. Michael and I have been riding through 100 plus degree weather. And extreme heat can be very lethal. In 2003, during the heat wave in Europe, 70,000 people died. And in 2010 in Russia, with a combined heat wave and a wave of forest fires, there were 65,000 people who died. The biggest event in the U.S. occurred in 1995 in Chicago, when over 700 people in Chicago died during a heat wave. And since then, our public health departments and our cities have gotten a lot smarter after that wake-up call at identifying the most vulnerable people and providing ways for them to get cool. This is a bus that the city of Chicago now runs and takes around to neighborhoods where there are lots of people at risk so that they can get on the bus and cool down. So what happens when we have a heat wave? We see increases for about every 10 degrees above average in summer temperature, we see about a 5% increase in deaths from cardiovascular disease and diabetes. We also see an increase in hospitalizations for things like kidney disease and dehydration, as well as the cardiopulmonary conditions. What we're looking at for the future, if we continue on our current course, is a very dramatic increase in the number of heat waves, the length of those heat waves, and their frequency, so that a heat wave like the one that we had back in Chicago would, instead of happening every 30 years by 2050, would be happening every several years, or even annually. And the same thing is true for extreme heat days, which can happen episodically and not necessarily in a row. The threshold for people to start dying or getting sick from extreme heat is not an absolute number. It depends on what people are accustomed to, because we do have the ability to adapt to temperature over time. So the temperature that might cause people to get sick or pass away in San Francisco, which is a relatively cool place, would be a different temperature than people would be experiencing that kind of effect in Los Angeles or maybe here in Nebraska in the summertime. The duration is also, the longer the heat wave lasts, the more effect it has, so that the same temperature that might not have caused problems on day one could have a severe impact on health by day five. So what are we looking at in terms of increased mortality in Chicago? This is the predictions. And there's two columns for the future, because one is looking at the red column is if we continue on our current course, and the yellow is if we are able to lower our emissions substantially. So it's not just heat waves where you have day after day of hot weather where we're seeing increased mortality. This is from a study that was done, a mega data kind of a analysis of Medicare data from 135 cities. And they followed everyone who was discharged from the hospital with four diagnoses: diabetes, congestive heart failure, heart attack, and COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, like emphysema. And what they found is that even if they controlled for heat waves, if they controlled for ozone that we're going to talk about, and income and all kinds of other possible explanations, they found that for every degree increase in summer temperature above average, they saw an increase in deaths. So if you look at our vital statistics, when they have the number of people that die from extreme heat, it's usually under 1,000 people per year in the United States. But looking at just the effect of these isolated hot days, they extrapolated that we have 10,000 deaths a year now because of increased temperatures due to climate change. And because it's Medicare, their definitions of young and old are different, and the more elderly people were more affected, which they're defining as being over 70. So then they went back and they looked at that data again. This is a very busy slide, but we're very interested in the health field now in health disparities and why it is that some groups have worse outcomes than others. And so they went back and looked at the effect of green space, and they found that people that lived in areas that had more green in the environment had less of an impact from increased temperature, and that people who lived in communities that had a higher percentage of non-white population had an increased impact. Ozone is another climate-related health impact that we're seeing, and ozone, when it's way up high, is beneficial for us because it's screening out ultraviolet rays and preventing skin cancers. But at ground level, it's a respiratory irritant and a cause of morbidity and mortality. And there's actually a no safe level of ozone. I mean, the EPA sets limits on set standards for what's considered damaging or not damaging to human health. But there's a lot of variation in the population in sensitivity to ozone. So younger folks and people who have chronic diseases, for example, or people who have asthma, are much more susceptible. So for every increase in ozone, even when under the EPA standard, we see an increase in deaths. Moving. Okay, I got a clicker problem here. Here we go. Back. Back. Okay. So people who have asthma are also affected by changes in ozone level, even below the EPA limits. And this is a study that was done at a summer camp for children with asthma. And for every increase in ozone, there was an increase in their use of rescue inhalers, the ones that that one would use when they're having an asthma attack. Likewise, with chronic exposure to ozone, we see people developing asthma, especially children, and that's because when people are exposed to ozone, the amount that they're receiving, the dose that they're getting, has to do with the rate that they breathe. And so children breathe faster than adults do, and their lungs are developing, so they're a little bit more prone. Kids who play sports have even higher rates of developing asthma if they are playing three or more sports in an area where there are high daytime levels of ozone. So this is just prediction of, this is just looking at chronic ozone exposure and rates of hospitalizations for asthma in children. And you can see that the more ozone exposure that these kids have, the higher the rates of asthma that they develop. And we're talking about sports and increased exposure. That's the study that was. And this is the ozone levels are increasing with climate change because ground level ozone is formed when the products of combustion combine in the presence of heat and sunlight. So the warmer it is, the higher the more ozone is formed at ground level. And this is a prediction of the result that we're going to see from increasing ozone production just from climate change by 2020 in the pediatric emergency room visits for asthma. So we're also seeing increases in pollen counts, which affects people with allergies and asthma. And this is the part on the left here is from an experiment that was done growing ragweed under different concentrations of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide acts as a fertilizer and increases plant growth and pollen production. So the first column is pre-industrial levels of CO2. The second was contemporary at the time, although we're now over 400 parts per minute. And the third column is what CO2 levels are anticipated to be in 2075, and you can see the increase. This same researcher went back and has done some more recent work projecting that pollen counts are going to double again between now and 2040. We're also seeing an increased length of the pollen season, particularly in the more northern parts of the country. And we're seeing allergy-producing plants moving into areas where before they were not commonly growing. We're also seeing increased exposure to mold as a result of increase in heavy rainfall and resultant flooding and leaking of homes. And in addition, with the current emphasis on energy efficiency and building of homes that are really tight, a lot of those homes do not have adequate air circulation, and so that promotes mold growth and poor indoor air quality. So what we know about mold is that if people are exposed who have asthma and allergies, that will provoke exacerbations and again increase visits to the hospital. But mold also causes asthma if children are exposed when they're young. And there was a study done where a cohort of kids was followed from birth until age 7, And air samples were taken from the home, and the children who had the highest amount of mold in those air samples at age 8 months had the highest rates of hospitalization for asthma before the age of 7. So with all of that, it's not surprising that the incidence of allergies and asthma have tripled since the 1960s. That probably is a multifactorial, but we know that climate is an important piece because of a study that was done by Quest, a large commercial laboratory, looking at the results of allergy tests that had been processed through that lab over a 4-year period. And what they found was that the percentage of positive tests for ragweed and mold increased 12% to 15%, while the percentage of positive reactions to other common allergens like animal dander and dust mites either decreased or stayed the same. Another effect of climate on air quality is dust, and we're having Southwest, we're having an increase in dust storms because with the near permanent drought conditions that we have, there is less vegetation to hold the soil down and more wind erosion. And the health consequence of that in that region has been an 800% increase in cases of valley fever, which is a type of pneumonia caused by inhaling a fungus in soil. And the situation has gotten so bad in California that that folks who are in two prisons that are down in the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley, about half the prison population had to be evacuated from the area because so many people were getting sick with valley fever. And if you're for young folks, people will spontaneously recover. But for older people who are black, Filipino diabetics, or who have suppressed immune function, then this is a fungal infection, spreads from the lungs and affects other organs and can be fatal. We also have to worry about dust from other places. About half the airborne dust in the U.S. comes from outside the country, from Asia coming in on the west coast and from Africa coming in on the east. And dust contains also bacteria, fungi, heavy metals, pesticides, and other substances. One concern that I have is about arianite, which is a fibrous mineral like asbestos that is formed in areas where there was former volcanic activity. And we know about the health effects of arianite from this region of Turkey. And I don't know, I was just very taken with the boutique cave motel. People used to live in these caves, but now you can spend a lot of money and stay in a very fancy cave room there. But in some villages where people built their homes from this same stone, about 50% of the people were dying from a rare form of lung cancer, also caused by asbestos, called mesothelioma, which is a cancer of the lining of the lungs. And it turns out that part of the problem it was that there was an increased genetic susceptibility to cancer in those villages, but the arianite exposure was combined with that is what was causing all of that mortality. And even when experimental animals are exposed to arianite, they develop mesotheliomas at a higher rate than when they're exposed to asbestos. So we have arianite in the United States, and this map is not complete, but these are some of the areas that we know of where arianite is present. And one concern is that there's a great deal of overlap between the areas where we're having the dust storms and epidemics of valley fever and the areas where the arianite is found. The only research that I've been able to locate about arianite in the U.S. has been done in North Dakota, where some roads were paved with gravel that contained arianite. Researchers have gone back and taken air samples and found that the levels of arianite fibers in those areas on the roads, inside school buses, inside homes, are as high as the levels from the cancer villages in Turkey. They have not found any radiographic changes suggestive of damage, and nobody has developed cancer yet, but the latency period is about 30 years between exposure and the development of cancer. In urban areas and in industrial areas where there's been mining or smelting or use of heavy metals, lead contamination and increased exposure to lead is another concern. When the soil is dry and the weather is hot, that lead that is in the soil, either as a legacy from our use of leaded gasoline or from some industrial or mining process, that lead is mobilized into the air. And when children breathe it in, then it elevates their blood lead levels. And the younger a child is, the less concentration of lead in the air it takes in order to elevate their blood lead. So this is from a study that was done in Indianapolis looking at blood lead levels in children. And you can see that that there's a spike in the summer and a trough in the winter. Just that pattern repeating over various seasons. The blue dots are the predicted blood lead levels based on air samples that were taken of dust concentration and lead concentration in the air, and the triangles are the actual blood lead concentration. So you can see that that model fits pretty well. And here are the actual measurements. Again, you've got that sinusoidal seasonal peak and trough of soil and lead in the atmosphere. This is from Detroit. And the consequence of this kind of chronic low-level exposure is a permanent brain damage in children. And the chart there is showing the relationship between the results of standardized test scores on 20,000 children in Detroit and their blood lead levels. And the higher the blood lead level, the poorer their performance on the standardized testing. So we have about 500,000 children in the U.S. who have blood lead levels that are in this range or higher. And this is a different problem than what we have usually focused on with childhood lead poisoning, which is, you know, having an old house and kids eating paint chips. And while it's expensive to remediate those old homes with peeling paint, it's practically impossible to take lead out of the soil of all of our urban areas. This is a concern for Omaha, I think, particularly where there's a Superfund site where 15,000 homes had soil in their yards contaminated with lead. Wildfire smoke is another air quality a detriment, and we've had a big increase not only in the number of wildfires but also in the acreage burned. And wildfire smoke contains irritants, carcinogens, and many other things, but the one that's most hazardous to human health are some very, very small particles called fine particulates that are easily inhaled into the lungs and then can also pass from the lungs into the bloodstream. They cause inflammation. And so when there is wildfire smoke exposure in a community, we see increases in emergency room visits and hospitalizations among people who have asthma and chronic lung disease, but we also often see increases in heart attacks and strokes. And this is a study that was done, again, looking at the health disparities that was done in North Carolina, and they're comparing groups of rural counties who were exposed and who were unexposed. So your blue dots are the exposed communities, and you can see the increases in emergency room visits for heart and lung conditions during that time they were exposed to the wildfire smoke. And then the researchers went back and looked at the same data and regrouped the counties in the smoke exposed communities by their county health rankings, which is a a ranking that is done nationally and takes into account a number of factors, including environmental, health services, socioeconomic, and a number of other things. And they found that in the communities that were at the bottom of the health ranking, the impact of wildfire smoke exposure was greater, and that it persisted beyond the end of the exposure. So you can see in the second graph over here is after the fire was out, and the folks who were in the communities that were the more advantaged communities that had the higher health rankings, things went back to normal for them pretty quickly. But in those communities that were in the bottom group, they were still having increased visits to the emergency room. And this is looking at asthma, and they also looked at emergency room visits for congestive heart failure and found the same pattern. So there is a strong element of environmental injustice in the health effects of climate change, because they don't fall equally on everyone. The fine particulates don't just stay where the fire is. They're actually quite mobile, and I know you've experienced that here in Nebraska when you got a lot of smoke last year from the fires in Colorado. This is from a NASA satellite showing particulates from a fire in New Mexico moving up to Denver, Colorado. We're also seeing an increase in heavy rainfall, about a 5% increase in rainfall overall, but much more coming down in heavier downpours and leading to flooding, because it can't all be absorbed. And when that happens, there is often contamination of drinking water treatment facilities and overflows of sewage treatment plants. We also have a fairly common type of sewer system in the United States called combined sewer overflow. And combined means that the same pipes that carry away the raw sewage also are carrying away rainwater. And overflow means that the systems are designed so that if there is too much going through those pipes, more than the treatment plant can handle, that the rest is dumped out unprocessed into the nearest river or lake or ocean. And I've got a picture of the Allegheny River up here because Pennsylvania, people swimming in the Allegheny River, because Pennsylvania is one of the, is the state in the U.S. that has the highest number of those outflow pipes. And sewage is one concern, but there's also other things that are removed in the process of water treatment that are missed when the water is, when the waste is dumped directly into surface water. There was a study done in the Allegheny River looking at fish, and they compared a group of fish that were caught near outflow pipes with fish that were caught in other areas of the river. And they made a kind of a fish extract and applied that to human breast cancer cells. And the extract from the fish that were caught near the outflow pipes made the cells multiply like crazy because of the estrogenic effect. Most of that is removed in the process of water treatment, but if it's dumped directly in the river, then it remains. So our sewer systems are not really designed to handle the type of heavy rainfall that we are now experiencing. And this is just showing you how storm water going down a storm drain comes back again mixed up with raw sewage up a manhole. And this is not an uncommon sight in on the streets and cities of America after heavy rain. So with all of that, it's not really surprising that there's a very strong association between gastroenteritis, which is passed by fecal material being consumed, so there's a strong link between that and heavy rainfall. So the majority of instances of drinking water contamination that happen in urban watersheds happen after heavy rainfall, And we see an increase in pediatric emergency room visits and a tripling of hospitalization of children who are the most vulnerable because they get dehydrated more rapidly following heavy rain. So our drinking water treatment and our sewage treatment systems are not up to the task of protecting us from the consequences of heavy rain and water contamination. Leptospirosis is the most common zoonosis or animal disease that's passed to people in the world. And we've had leptospirosis in the United States for quite some time. And up until recently, it had been more of an occupational disease. This is something that affects wild animals. It affects livestock and even human pets. And people catch it when the urine, when they come into contact with urine from infected animals that's carrying the bacteria. And with increased rainfall, there is more of that urine is reaching water that people can become exposed to. So what we're seeing now is this is becoming a consequence of water recreation. There have been several outbreaks associated with triathlons, and some whitewater paddlers have also been affected. And since the 1990s, we've had about a doubling in the incidence of leptospirosis in the United States. And since 2000, we've seen the same pattern mirrored in dogs. And so veterinarians are now vaccinating dogs against leptospirosis. So leptospirosis is a pretty serious disease. It can be treated, but it's with antibiotics, but most physicians wouldn't recognize it. And it begins with a flu-like illness, progresses to hepatitis, and then to acute kidney failure. So with all that I've been telling you, it is not, it's not surprising that we're having an increase in infectious disease outbreaks related to recreation and water. And health departments are spending a great deal of resources monitoring the coliform count at beaches and closing down beaches to recreation when there have been sewage outflows. We see another set of effects on water that have to do with increased water temperature. And this is a remote surface temperature sensing chart that is being used experimentally to try to determine when oysters are safe to harvest. There is a bacteria called Vibrio, which is a common marine bacteria that multiplies faster in warmer water. And it has been a huge, not only a cause of illness, but also a cause of big financial losses in the aquaculture industry because of illnesses that result from a consumption of shellfish that are infected with Vibrio. So you can see this is just a chart from the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that gets put out by the CDC showing rates of bacterial illnesses that are foodborne. And you can see that the rates of Vibrio infection have gone up quite a bit. Vibrio is also, it causes only about 20% of the illnesses from consumption of shellfish, but about 95% of the deaths, because it in one form, it's just like a severe vomiting and diarrhea, but in people who are older or in people who have liver problems, it also can be septicemia, where the bacteria goes immediately into the bloodstream and starts affecting vital organs. So the other 80% of the illnesses from eating shellfish are related to toxins that are produced by harmful algae blooms in the ocean, also provoked by warmer ocean temperatures. And there are several types of toxic shellfish poisoning. Paralytic shellfish poisoning can begin about 30 minutes after shellfish are consumed, and within 2 hours can result in complete paralysis and respiratory failure. It is reversible with time, but there's no treatment other than supportive care. Amnesic shellfish poisoning causes permanent loss of short-term memory and seizures. And in California, we've been having episodes of young marine mammals washing up on shore that are in pretty bad shape. And some research has shown that that's the result of another toxin produced by harmful algae blooms called domoic acid. And domoic acid, when consumed by pregnant rats at levels that are not high enough to cause illness in the mother, passes through the placenta and causes brain damage and seizures in the offspring. Amoebic meningoencephalitis is a rare condition, but it is kind of like a marker for climate change. This is an amoeba called Naegleria that lives in lakes, and its activity is sensitive to temperature. It's in an inactive form when the water is cold, and as the water gets warmer, it moves into a reproductive phase. This affects healthy young children and is almost uniformly fatal. There's only been one child ever in the United States to survive this infection. And we have these, we see this episodically in the southern tier of states and have for a long time. What's new is that in 2010 and again in 2012, we have had children die in Minnesota after swimming in a lake in Minnesota when the nearest former infections were 500 miles to the south. So we're now having lakes in Minnesota that are warm enough to result in exposure to active Naegleria infection. In freshwater, we're also seeing increase in harmful algae blooms. This is actually partly due to water temperature and to heavy rains, which are washing nutrients in agricultural areas into the water. And blue-green algae forms a number of different toxins, but the one that is of the greatest concern is microcystin, and it is toxic to the liver. And if that water is drunk or swallowed in the course of recreation, it can cause acute hepatitis. And with chronic low-level exposures, it causes liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma. And this is increasingly common in the U.S. and particularly in the Midwest. And surveys of lakes have shown that in the summertime, about a third of the lakes in the Midwest have levels of microcystin high enough to cause harm to people. And this is another increased expense for public health departments now monitoring levels of microcystin and closing down beaches when the levels get too high. This is particularly dangerous for dogs and children because the crust of algae that forms along the shoreline often has levels of microcystin that are 1,000 times higher than the levels out in the middle of the lakes. On land, with increased temperature and with drought, we are seeing increased presence of aflatoxin in our corn harvest. Aflatoxin is formed by a mold, Aspergillus, that affects corn when it is grown in drought conditions, and it is one of the most potent natural carcinogens that is known. It causes liver cancer by binding to DNA in the liver and turning off a tumor suppressor gene. And exposure to aflatoxins, documented by the presence of aflatoxin biomarkers in blood or urine, is associated with a tripling of risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma. But when aflatoxin really causes a problem is in people who already have some type of chronic inflammation of the liver. And this is the areas that of the country, the green diamonds are the areas of the country where we have had harvests that were contaminated with aflatoxin at levels that were either too high for human consumption, too high for feed to dairy cows because the aflatoxin will come out in the milk, or too high to feed to animals that were to be slaughtered for human consumption. And what the Food and Drug Administration did in four states was they, instead of requiring that this corn be destroyed, they authorized the farmers to be able to blend it with corn that was unaffected to bring the aflatoxin levels down below their allowable limits. This could easily have the effect of doubling, tripling, quadrupling, who knows, our exposure to aflatoxin. So in people that have chronic inflammation in the liver, aflatoxin increases the risk of liver cancer 60 to 100 times. And this is a study that was done, these are some studies that were done in Asia where chronic active hepatitis B is the source of the chronic liver inflammation. In the United States, we have more problem with hepatitis C, especially in the baby boomer population, and with something called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is at epidemic proportions. And we are seeing liver cancer developing, HCC, hepatocellular carcinoma, in people who have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, even if they don't have cirrhosis, which was traditionally thought to be required in order to for someone to be at risk of developing liver cancer. And this is, liver cancer is the fastest growing cause of cancer death in the United States now. So somewhere between 30 and 40% of adults in the U.S. are affected by non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, as documented by ultrasound. And again, this is not distributed evenly. Hispanic populations have higher rates, as do Native Americans, although that is not on this chart. And they have correspondingly higher levels of liver cancer as a result. The Asian and Pacific Islanders have the highest, again, because of the chronic hepatitis B, with Native Americans and Hispanics following close behind due to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So we're also seeing effects on groundwater quality and quantity due to drought and aquifer depletion. And when there is less surface water available, there's more pumping of water for irrigation and for domestic use. And that has the effect of decreasing water quality. The mechanisms for different types of contamination are different. Arsenic is present naturally in the environment, and when it's in an aquifer and it's covered with water, it's generally in a stable form and that isn't soluble, so it's not causing any harm. But if the aquifer is pumped down and the water table drops, then that arsenic is exposed and it's oxidized to another form called arsenite, which is not only very mobile to move into the water, but also is 10 times more toxic than arsenic. And this can be removed from drinking water, but it is a big expense for places that are have small drinking water systems and small populations, like a lot of the towns in Nebraska. And I did some training at two local health departments yesterday, and they were telling me that this is a problem that is being experienced here. So arsenic, we're all familiar with arsenic being used for murder and poisoning, but chronic low-level exposure increases bladder cancer and skin cancer. And you can see again that there's no safe level. A little bit gives some people cancer and more gives more people cancer. It also does result in decreased immune response. And in Africa, where this has been a big problem from due to drought and pumping a lot of water from wells that isn't that and not recharging the aquifer, that it has been thought to be responsible for some of the spread of HIV infection just due to a decreased immune response. Nitrate is another common cause of water contamination here and in many agricultural areas. And when there is drought, we see, first of all, a drop in nitrate contamination of groundwater. But farmers apply fertilizer for the crop that they hope to see, and if the crop doesn't do well, then it's not taking up the nitrogen, and then come the next big rainfall, and that nitrogen is going down into and contaminating the groundwater. So we see a spike in nitrogen contamination after a drought, and exposure to nitrate again at levels below the EPA standards. Causes increased thyroid cancer and hypothyroidism. That's from a study that was done on over 20,000 women who living in farm communities in Iowa. In babies, and it is it causes something called the blue baby syndrome, where that the nitrate is converted into nitrite, and it binds to hemoglobin, the red part of blood, and prevents it from being able to carry as much oxygen, so the baby turns blue. And is also a cause of congenital birth defects, and particularly anencephaly, which is when babies are born without a brain. We're also seeing an increase in insect-borne infections, and West Nile virus is a case in point. We first had West Nile virus in New York State in 1999, and within 5 years it had spread all the way across the country. Climate change has been implicated in helping with the speed of that spread, because when temperatures are warmer, the breeding season for mosquitoes is extended. The time for them to come to maturity is lessened, and if they're carrying viruses, the viruses are multiplying faster. So we've had, I think I looked up the statistics for this state today, and we've had 32 documented cases of West Nile virus, but most cases of infection are asymptomatic. Only about one in every five people who is infected has any symptoms at all. And even those are just a few flu-like illness. So the ones that come to the attention of public health and get reported are the cases where there is neuroinvasion, where the virus invades the nervous system, causing either encephalitis, inflammation of the brain, or myelitis, inflammation of the spinal cord. So for every case that's reported, there are probably at least 150 other infections that occurred. In the southern part of the country, we've had a resurgence of dengue fever. This was present in those areas in the past, but it was eradicated during World War II, but now is again on the rise. And this is a photo taken from Florida of a truck spraying insecticide, trying to lower the mosquito population. There was an attempt to release some sterile mosquitoes and to interrupt the breeding cycle, but the people in Florida got up in arms about it, and so that didn't happen. Dengue fever, the folk name for it is breakbone fever, because a primary dengue infection causes a sort of a high fever and severe pains in the joints. If a person has dengue fever more than once, however, then they get something called hemorrhagic fever or the dengue shock syndrome, in which the body's immune system, in recognizing and attempting to respond to the infection, revs up and instead of just attacking the virus, attacks the patient as well and causes a failure in the clotting of blood, so that people develop a bruising on their skin and can have bleeding from their mouth and from their GI tract, and the blood vessels become leaky and fluid accumulates in the lungs and the abdomen, blood pressure drops. And without excellent supportive care, this is about 50% fatal. And I say supportive care because for all these viral illnesses, there's no treatment of the primary infection. All we can do is try to support that person's blood pressure and their breathing and wait for their body to overcome the infection, if it does. When we had, since 1990, we've had 7 outbreaks of dengue in Texas, and 1 in Hawaii, and 3 in South Florida. And after one of the infection, outbreaks in South Florida, the state health department wondered about the extent of the infection. Again, because cases that are reported are usually just the tip of the iceberg. So they went out from household to household, and they did blood tests looking for antibodies to the dengue virus. And what they found was that about 1 out of every 5 samples showed evidence of recent dengue infection. So if those folks were to get infected again, they would be having the hemorrhagic and shock type of dengue and not just the breakbone fever. Something that I learned yesterday from the health department in Grand Island, where they had a little outbreak of dengue that actually was brought back from a group that went to help out in Haiti. And they were there for a week, and 25% of the group came down with dengue. And what they experienced, and the CDC came in, and what they found was that people who had had West Nile virus before had a more severe form of dengue. 4 out of 5 of the people who had had West Nile virus were hospitalized because with sort of, somewhere in between a case description of primary dengue and the dengue hemorrhagic fever, because the antibodies had enough cross-reactivity to provoke that kind of a reaction. So there hasn't been anything published on that, but it's certainly suggestive of something that to be alarmed about and concerned about. So this is just a map showing you the return of dengue to the Americas. And everything that I said about the effect of temperature on mosquitoes holds true for dengue, but also the mosquito type, which is the best transmitter, the best vector for dengue infections, can't survive winter freezes. And so with our milder winters that we're having, the area of the country where that mosquito can thrive has increased. So it's living in places where it couldn't live before. Dengue is associated with increased temperature and of course with rainfall, because that provides stagnant water and opportunities for the mosquitoes to breed. And this is just a predictive model that was developed looking at temperature and rainfall as a way to predict dengue outbreaks. And it is 95% sensitive, 98% specific, which means that if it says that there's going to be an outbreak, there's pretty much going to be an outbreak. Chagas disease is sometimes called the AIDS of the Americas, because when a person gets infected with Chagas, which is a parasite, it's common in Latin America, they don't often have any symptoms, but about 30% of those people will develop congestive heart failure later as a result. And Chagas is transmitted by a bite of an insect called a triodomine, and they are blood-sucking insects, and they carry the parasite that causes Chagas. If we don't have a lot of Chagas in the U.S. that was acquired here. We've got about 300,000 people in the U.S. that have Chagas disease, estimated, but most of them are immigrants who came here from Latin America. But we are screening our blood supply, because Chagas can be transmitted by blood transfusion. It can also be transmitted vertically from a pregnant mother to her unborn baby, and by the consumption of food or water that's contaminated with the feces of the triodomine bug. So since we have been monitoring our blood supply, we're starting to see cases of Chagas in people who were never outside of the United States. And the theory had been, up until then, that we didn't get Chagas here in the U.S. because the bug bites at night, and we have better housing, and so it can't get in to bite us. That's how the theory went. But researchers have been down in California and Arizona catching triodomain bugs and looking at the contents of their GI tract. And they found that about 50% of the bugs are carrying the parasite, and about 40% of them had recently fed on humans. And this is what triodomains eat for breakfast, or I should say dinner if they're biting at night. So the only two standing theories about why we're not seeing more Chagas in the U.S. Are these. One is from an entomologist who studied the behavior of the insects, and he found that the insects in Latin America defecate while they're feeding, so there's more chance that the parasite will go into the puncture wound made by the insect and infect the person, and that the insects in North America defecate after feeding. So all there is between us and the, you know, the fourth biggest killer in Latin America are the bathroom habits of a bug. But the other factor is that the activity of triodomain insects depends on temperature, and the warmer it is, the more active they become in feeding and in reproducing. So to try to sum all that up in one slide, our health is not something that we can guarantee as individuals by taking vitamins or jogging or any of those things. We are dependent upon having clean air, clean water, safe food, and a safe environment for our health. And if climate change is affecting all of those factors, then it is going to make us sick as well. So the group that I belong to, Climate 911, which is a national group of health professionals, we believe that climate change is a public health emergency. If we continue on our current trajectory, we're going to see an increase in temperature of 7 to 12 degrees by the end of the century. And why are we talking out here, talking about health? Why did Climate 911 form? Because climate communication research shows that this is one of the best ways to get people to understand climate change. It takes something that is sort of abstract and possibly in the future and brings it down to a level that people have personal experience with. And so there's been research done with focus groups talking about polar bears and grandchildren and all kinds of things, and talking about health effects of climate change seems to be what works. The other reason is because we are struggling, as in the medical profession, with an epidemic, a rising tide of lifestyle-related diseases. And I like to put these two pie charts next to each other. The one on the left is a source of greenhouse gas production in the United States, and the one on the right are the top 10 causes of death in America. And the reason that these two look the same is because when we burn the fossil fuels, that is creating a lot of our health problems. So how does that happen? For one thing, we are increasingly dependent on automobiles and moving less and less under our own power. So the trend is really disturbing. And when you compare us with other developed countries, you can see that we compare very poorly in the amount of walking and cycling that we do in our daily lives. So what is the effect of that? We know from research that about one-third of all obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and some very common forms of cancer are directly attributable to that physical inactivity. So what could we do about that? We need to put some policies into place that will help get people out of their cars. And this is beyond the realm of healthcare and from one way of looking at it, and very much our business from another. So we need to have the policies for housing funding and zoning that will allow mixed-use development so that the things that people need in their daily lives are close enough to walk and bike. We need to have safe routes to and from, and in urban areas at least we need to be able to combine that with some public transit. People who use public transit are more likely to get the recommended physical minutes of physical exercise per week than people who drive in their car. So it is also active transportation. If we did that, this is the immediate public health benefits that we would accrue if we could just get people moving. You can see 570,000 cases of diabetes would be prevented. Now, the only good thing about healthcare in the United States being so expensive is that this represents a huge savings. And a study that was done just looking at active transportation strategy for the San Francisco Bay Area showed several billion dollars a year in savings in health spending. The methodology for that study came from this one that was done looking at the savings to the National Health Service in England from an active transportation strategy in London. And you can see how it breaks down everything from diabetes to dementia. So large financial savings from keeping people healthy. We also need to maximize our efficiency, both of buildings, homes and commercial buildings and public buildings, and of our motor vehicles. I think it's inexcusable that it will take until 2020 for cars in the United States to have the same fuel economy as cars that are now being produced in Japan and in the EU. If it's possible technologically for us to do that, we should be doing it. We also need to make the move to clean energy now. If we export our coal to other countries and it's burned in other countries, it's going to warm the climate everywhere. The not in my backyard kind of environmentalism is really something that we have to throw away and start thinking globally, because that's how these effects are occurring. We need to stop investing our capital in fossil fuel burning power plants, and we need to find a way, either by cap and trade or carbon tax or pollution fines, to adequately price, add in the social cost of dirty energy. So when we're comparing clean alternatives and fossil fuels, we're looking at all of the costs and not just some of them. If we were able to do all of those things, we would have an immediate benefit in terms of improvement in air quality and decrease in heart and lung disease. And we know that from the Olympics, both in when it was in Atlanta and in Beijing. And in both of those cities, they restricted use of automobiles in the central part of those cities, and there was an immediate drop in emergency room and hospital use for respiratory conditions. And again, we'd be looking at savings of something like over $100 billion a year. We also need to take a look at our farm policy and subsidize sustainable farming and the production of the foods that we're telling people to eat. Because if we're subsidizing corn to feed to cattle on the one hand, and then we have the Department of Health and Human Services saying you don't eat so much meat, eat more vegetables, so it's completely contradictory. These need to be harmonized. And right now, we are consuming about almost twice as much as the recommended amount of red meat, while only a quarter of the U.S. population gets enough servings of fruits and vegetables. If we were able to do that, again, we would see some very rapid and substantial public health benefits. I'm going to skip that slide. So why don't we just tell people to eat more vegetables and go for walks? Because it doesn't work. I can tell you from 30 years of experience as a practicing primary care physician, but we have plenty of studies that say the same thing. The only thing that doctors tell people to do that has any documented lasting effect is when we say to quit smoking. But in terms of advice and diet and exercise, there's no lasting effect has been shown. What we do know, what we do know is that policy changes and changes in the environment, the food environment and the built environment, do get results. If we put a supermarket in a low-income neighborhood, we can increase consumption of vegetables by families by 30%. We know that walkable communities have lower rates of high blood pressure, of heart disease, of diabetes, and that inhabitants weigh about 10 pounds less on average. We know that people who live near freeways have higher rates of heart disease and asthma. So these are the types of changes that do work and that we need to put into effect. So I've got a picture of an old pump up here, and this is in London, and it's there because it's a very famous pump. Back in the 1800s, there was a cholera epidemic, and cholera is a type of it's actually a type of Vibrio infection, but not the kind that we're seeing here in the U.S. And it causes very rapid death from dehydration. But back in the 1800s, they didn't know that germs caused disease. But there was a physician by the name of John Snow, and he made a map of all of the cases of cholera where those people resided, and was able to narrow the source of the infection down to this pump and the water that it was producing that was contaminated with cholera. So what did Dr. John Snow do? He did not go out into the neighborhood and talk to people about trying to drink a little less water. He marched down there and he took the handle off the pump. So those are the kind of solutions. That's what a public health solution is. And those are the kind of solutions that we need to demand of our government. So this is the platform of the of Climate 911. We want to see an increase in federal transportation dollars that are going for active transportation. Right now it's 1%. We want to see national programs for increasing the energy efficiency of cars and homes. We want investment in clean energy and a farm policy that promotes growing and consumption of more vegetables. Out of all of our farm subsidies, only 1% now goes for growing vegetables. So what I'm doing as I'm riding across the country is collecting endorsements from health professionals of our prescription for climate action. And when I get to Washington, D.C., I will be joined by a bunch of colleagues, and we're going to deliver these prescriptions to Congress and try to make it very clear that this is a health problem. It's not an environmental problem. It's a public health problem that we all need. We need a response. So if you are in the health field or if you know people who are health professionals, I would appreciate it very much if you would get them to visit our website and do an online endorsement. It takes about a minute of the prescription for climate action so that we can go represent them with your Nebraska legislators. So why do we have to do it now? Because there's really very little time left, especially when it comes to capital investment in energy and generation of electricity. We are almost locked into continued use of fossil fuel. Also, because the longer we wait to act, the higher the resulting temperature will be. I like this other slide. It says the same thing, but so much so much nicer to look at. We really have no time to lose in lowering our emissions. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.